So yeah, so today I want to talk about recent work with Tom Melia and Surjit Rajendran on detecting dark blobs, which are a type of dark matter. And if you don't know what dark blobs are, that's totally okay. I will introduce what we call dark blobs. So the motivation for this work really starts with the observation that if you look at the dark matter mass landscape, it really covers over 90 orders of magnitude. So if you think about the lightest dark matter that you could have versus the heaviest, that spans 90 orders of magnitude from a ZeV to about 10 to the 60 GeV. And to sort of work in perhaps more natural units, recall that a ZeV is 10 to the minus 24 electron volts, and 10 to the 60 GeV is 10 to the 3 solar masses. So that really covers 90 orders of magnitude. And as physicists, we're trying to find ways to rule out or perhaps find the dark matter over these 90 orders of magnitude. So generally, there are three classifications of dark matter that we look for. And all three of these types of dark matter have their own unique observational methods and really criteria for the detectors that are used to look for these dark matter candidates. So the first one, going from the lightest to the heaviest, the first classification is this ultralight dark matter that goes from about a ZeV to a KeV. And these are your axions, your ALPS, pretty much any particle that, when you think about the Milky Way dark matter halo, you can treat as some sort of classically oscillating coherent field. And the reason why we generally think of them as this classical field is in our detectors, we utilize this classical coherence to compensate for a very, very weak coupling. Right? So if you think about the axion coupling is very, very tiny, but because you sort of have this sloshing field in the Milky Way that's coherent, you can compensate for that weak coupling. And so again, so that goes from about a ZeV to about a KeV. The next one is your standard, perhaps original candidates for dark matter, which are these particle dark matters. And those generally have a mass from about a KeV, about maybe to a PeV. And these are your WIMPs, your hidden sector, your asymmetric. So these are dark matter that you can really just treat completely as a particle, usually elementary, but it's just a particle. And of course, these particles have very, very small cross sections with the standard model. And so to compensate, if you have any hope of detecting them, because of the small cross-section, you need a really, really high number density through your detector. So you make, for example, lux as big as possible. You have many, 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 many atoms. And even though the dark matter has a very small cross-section, you have many dark matter passing through your detector. And therefore, you can hope to maybe see a couple every year. So again, so to compensate for the small cross-sections, you need a high number density. And then there's a jump. You essentially leave out anything between a PeV to 10 to the 50 GeV. So again, that's about 10 to the minus 7 solar masses. You can go a little bit lower. But these are your macroscopic dark matter. So this is your primordial black holes, your machos, pretty much anything that if you're really looking for it, you don't look for any other interactions apart from gravity. And so in this mass regime, you're interaction is, again, very, very weak. As we know, gravity is a very, very weak force. Luckily, these objects have very, very large masses. So you can compensate for the weakness of gravity by the high mass. So these are sort of generally, very broadly speaking, the three classifications of dark matter that are commonly looked for. I want to focus in on this jump right here. So this jump essentially goes from about 10 to the 10 GeV about really 10 to the 42 GeV, where here you can maybe start looking for like Fenta lensing if you have primordial black holes. And now you can ask, why aren't there sort of more experiments or more dark matter candidates in this mass regime? Why is that line a sort of empty? And the reason is it's actually really, really difficult to probe dark matter with these masses, simply because your number density is really low. So what I mean by this is imagine you set up a detector and you want to have at least one dark matter passing through the detector per year. So as you increase the mass of the dark matter, your number density goes down, and so you have to make a larger detector. So you can ask, okay, if I have xenon 1 ton, what is the heaviest dark matter I could see such that it passes through xenon 1 ton once per year? And that gets you about up to 10 to the 19 GeV. If it's any heavier, it will not pass through xenon 1 ton once per year. I'm not even talking about whether it interacts. I'm just saying just passes through your detector.
What about WIMP-ZILLAs?
So WIMP-ZILLAs, I believe, are sort of up in this regime. There are searches you can do for them, but you are going to be limited by this issue. So I don't want to say there's never been any candidates in this mass regime. It's just there's few and they're hard to look for is really what I'm getting at. But I believe WIMP-ZILLAs actually top out at the Planck scale. So luckily xenon 1 ton just catches them. Okay, so assuming you want to go past the Planck scale, you have to go composite. But still, if your dark matter goes up to 10 to the 22 GeV, now you need a detector that's an Olympic swimming pool, which is big, but we have Olympic swimming pools. Maybe you can make a sensitive detector. Going up another order of magnitude, 10 to the 33 GeV, now you better hope that you can use the entire Earth as your detector. So good luck having good sensitivity on that, because that is massive. That is the largest terrestrial detector you could have. And if you get up all the way to 10 to the 42, then your detector has to go from the Earth to the Sun in that volume. So again, no one's really going to build a detector that big. So because of this, simply because your number density drops so much for these masses, it is really, really difficult to look for dark matter in this regime. And it's important that we try and find ways to actually do that. Okay, so my plan for the talk is I really have two goals. The first is to convince you that there actually are dark matter candidates that live in this mass regime. Because if we can't find any, then perhaps it's not worth looking for them if it's really that difficult. So I'm going to show an illustrative dark matter candidate. This is not the only one that you could have in this mass regime, but it will work nicely to demonstrate what I'm going for. And so the model we're going to use is a strongly coupled dark sector that has an asymmetry, so it has a baryon number. And it undergoes early universe dark nucleosynthesis. And this will allow us to get dark matter in the mass of 10 to the 20, 10 to the 30 GeV. And then once I've hopefully convinced you that it is reasonable to ask about dark matter in that mass, my second goal is to actually show you that despite the issue with the number density, you can actually use Earth-based detectors to cover at least some of that parameter space. Not all of it, but some of it. And what you're going to have to utilize is that, with this strongly coupled dark sector, you essentially have composite dark matter. So you have a large number of constituents that can compensate for weak coupling. And even for me, more interesting is that there are multiple ways that you could detect these dark nuclei depending on how they couple to the standard model. So it's not that you have to depend on only one type of coupling. You can actually look at various couplings. You have to use different experiments, but it's doable. And more importantly, you can place constraints on these objects using either existing experiments or near future. So I'm not saying let's go build another multi-million dollar detector. We can actually use what's already being done, which I think is really, really nice. Okay, so with that plan in mind, as always, please feel free to stop me with questions. So remember, my first goal is to try and convince you that it is reasonable to look in the mass regime between about 10 to the 10 GeV, ideally up to 10 to the 42 GeV, but I'm going to stick to maxing out at 10 to the 33 GeV. So please note that this following discussion of this dark QCD, the strongly interacting dark sector, it's just meant to be illustrative. It's meant to be motivating. It is not a full scanning of all possible strongly interacting theories. I'm not going to be deriving anything using lattice data or phenomenological models. Strongly coupled theories have emergent phenomena, so it is generally hard to make very strong predictive statements, but you can get the general shape of things. So just keep in mind, this is illustrative, not exhaustive. And also note that this is not my model. strongly interacting asymmetric dark sectors have been studied extensively in literature. Here are just some of the recent papers. And again, this is a non-extensive list. There has been a fair amount of work on this before, both from lattice people and from particle physicists or high energy physicists or phenomenologists. Okay, so as I've mentioned, my illustrative model is going to be a strongly interacting dark sector with a conserved quantum number, like baryon number. So it's essentially its dark QCD. And so from our knowledge of how nuclear physics works, and from sort of naive scaling arguments, we can at least get a handle on the general properties of this theory. So recall that generally in a confining theory, when your theory confines, it does so at an energy scale lambda. And that generally sets, it's your single dimensional flow parameter, and that generally sets all the other scaling laws for your theory. So much like in QCD, if the dark sector confines at an energy scale lambda, you're going to have massive particles whose mass goes like lambda. And these are your dark nucleons. They're composite objects, or they're confined objects. And so they have a radius that scales like 1 over lambda. Again, there's no other dimension flow parameter in your theory, so this is really all that it can be. Now, if these dark nucleons, if these massive particles are allowed to bind together, then they will form bound states, sort of like a nucleus. These are our dark nuclei. They'll again have a mass that's essentially the number of constituents times the confinement scale. And their radius scales geometrically. So like the number of constituents to the 1/3 divided by lambda, again, the only dimensionful parameter. And it is important to note, since I am talking about a dark matter, one can ask, what about the relic density? How do I make sure I get the correct one? We have an asymmetry. My relic abundance is set by that dark baryon asymmetry. So I'm always going to assume that I can just tune it as need be. Because all I really want is that we have some dark sector that has these dark nucleons and a dark nucleus. And I'm not going to worry about the relic abundance. Okay, so you can ask, well, so we know that we should generally get dark nucleons. How do we know whether they bind up into a nucleus? And how large can these nucleus get, or these nuclei get? So in order to figure that out, we again go into our toolkit from nuclear physics, and we pull out the semi-empirical mass formula, which is proven to work really quite well for QCD. So we assume it'll work reasonably well for something that is QCD-like. So the semi-empirical mass formula is derived by assuming that a nucleus can just be treated as a drop of water, and that the binding energies just depend on the number of constituents in a predictable way. So generally, you have three contributions to the binding energy. You have this volume term, which is due to the strong interactions that are short range. Think about in QCD, you have the pions. They have a finite range. So your pions can only sort of make the nucleons interact with their nearest neighbors. You have a surface correction, essentially, because the nucleons on the surface of your water droplet don't have neighbors sort of at larger radii. So you have to correct for that, the fact that you have a finite droplet. And then there's a long-range weak interaction. So this is your Coulomb term. And essentially, this term says that, you know, your nucleon can interact with all of the other nucleon in the droplet because you're dealing with a long-range interaction. So for now, let us assume that there is no long-range interaction in the dark sector. It's just the strong interactions. And in this case, if we drop this term, you see that as you include more nucleons, the binding energy grows. So what this means is that the larger your nuclei, the more deeply bound it is. This is, of course, very different from the standard model, where you have this Coulombic term and you top out at iron 56.
But sorry, but the energy density per nucleon drops down. The energy per nucleon drops, because if you divide right?
Yeah, but it's still stable, so you're still allowed to pack them more in, right? So it's sort of
Yeah, so what I'm wondering is then how do you get them to bind, right? We're discussing this, so you're not putting a long-range interaction.
Yeah.
But then you run into the problem, how do you form them? At the beginning, you're going to be pi to the theory, but eventually the binding energy must be much less than the pi mass.
Yeah.
That can happen very quickly.
Yeah.
The question is how is that consistent with forming these huge blobs?
Yeah, so let's see if I can get at this. So I would say that I can't use this for sort of my initial, you know, couple. This only really works when I actually already have a fairly large object, right? So if I look at the semi-empirical mass formula for the standard model, it doesn't work for like a less than 10. So you really have to go to larger
nuclei.
Yeah.
But then the problem is then, especially then it becomes so big, the energy to add one more nucleon is so low, the binding energy. So you need so what is it that you emit? So you have a free particle that and wants to bind with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you emit for this guy to bind, to preserve energy and momentum?
Yeah, so you can have, you know, a light pion, you can have some sort of dark radiation.
Yeah, but that means the pion has to be anomalously light, right? You agree? Because otherwise if you take the standard model, you don't buy
pions. Right.
Right? So because the pion is 100 MeV, the binding energy per nucleon is not 100.
Right.
So I'm saying I think that having a long range interaction is crucial for what you say.
Right, and so in a couple of slides, I will include a long-range interaction, and there is a bound from this about how weakly interacting it can be.
Yeah,
Or you could also switch it off at some point, I guess, right, cosmologically?
No, you could give it a mass, and then there's a finite range, and you grow to a certain size, and then you grow, but, I mean... Anyway, continue. It's just that I think that if you're going to talk for very large numbers, I'm not sure how self-consistent is to ignore that term.
Yeah, and so I agree. So again, this is my, it's motivating, not illustrative. And so I agree that, you know, especially if I will at some point want a long-range interaction, so I do have to take this into account carefully. And this has been looked at in greater detail than I'm presenting here. And I will point to those papers maybe in two slides. And so people have actually done like nuclear phenological models to try and get at it. So yeah, this was just sort of motivating that the binding energy is really unbound from above. And so you can, assuming you have some way of fusing it, there is no sort of maximally stable dark nuclei, unlike in the standard model.
Sorry, it's kidding. Is it easy to understand for this?
So that scaling is essentially, so I'm assuming already large a number of constituents. Oh God. So that's just nearest neighbor, and then divided by essentially a volume scaling. This is all neighbors.
Yeah.
So essentially, if you think about like Coulomb.
Yeah.
And I hope I spelled Coulomb right. So these are all valid concerns about these sorts of models, and they have been looked at and thought about.
Automatically introduce a maximum, right?
Yes. And so you then have to think about how strongly it can couple, and that'll all get taken into account, I promise. Okay. Good. Okay, so modulo that discussion. If you are allowed to grow as large as you want, if you can ignore for right now this long-range interaction, then the only thing that limits the maximum size of the dark nuclei is really how quickly they can fuse in the early universe. Mainly, if you want these dark nuclei to form sort of in a BBN-type way, then they have some finite size finite time in which to interact, undergo fusion, and grow. So you can do an easy back-of-the-envelope calculation to see what this maximum size is. Essentially, compare the fusion rate to the Hubble rate, using that the fusion cross-section is going to be approximately geometric. You're going to have a thermal bath, and so that has the thermal velocity distribution, And your number density drops with the number of constituents that are locked inside a dark nuclei, or dark nucleus. So you can do that calculation and pull out the maximum mass. And of course, that will scale with exactly, you know, when you undergo this freeze out for the fusion and your confinement scale. But really what I want to draw your eye to is I2 is this prefactor in front of the maximum mass of the blob. And notice that it's 10 to the 15 GeV. So what this says, because you don't have this Coulombic barrier, essentially your dark nuclei will fuse until their number density drops so low that they can no longer find each other. And unlike in the standard model, this happens when they're exponentially large.
So you're making some assumption about the entropy per nucleon.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is the assumption you're making?
Sorry, what do you mean? In terms of the binding energy or in terms of...
So in standard BBN,
yeah,
you don't reach like large nuclei because the photon to baryon number is so high.
Yeah.
And so you're making some analogous assumption about that, you know, quantity per.
Yes. Mainly that it can happen. I mean, and there's sort of there that the I mean, because you can think about like there's a bottleneck that happens in the standard model, and it doesn't really happen in this because we're sort of assuming a bottleneck free sector.
But you're assuming a very low entropy per nucleon.
Yes, I believe.
I think the question is another way to say the question. I think it's fixed by the dark matter abundance.
Yeah.
Because you have to fix how many baryons you have. So there is an asymmetry because you only produce one type of baryon.
Yeah.
So, and there is a temperature of the heated sector, which is T higher. So there's the ratio of T is our temperature,
right.
T is the temperature of the twin sector, and the abundance of these guys is set by requiring that they are the dark matter.
Yeah.
So by requiring that the redshift is dark matter, you get how much. What is the baryon asymmetry, the ratio between these things and the let's say the photons of that sector versus T cubed? I mean,
right.
So there is some temperature in that.
Yeah, sector. And so. There.
Yeah.
Right. So this was also my caveat of, you know, I assume that I can get the Rayleigh abundance correct, you know, and that essentially the dark radiation that I sort of use for my thermal bath isn't going to contribute anything bad because I can normally scale it away. And so you know, this again, if you really want to do this carefully, which of course one should, you do have to solve, you know, the Boltzmann codes, you know, of growing these large nuclei and having, you know, the correct temperatures and things like that. And this has been looked at.
The temperature of the dark radiation bath.
Yeah.
The higher the final mass of your composite object.
Yeah.
Which is like the opposite of like what I would have labeled thought. Because like the higher the entropy, the faster the Hubble expansion rate. And but you're saying that doesn't
happen. Yeah. So.
No, because here you're not dominated.
Yeah.
Here it's not dominated by the
dark radiation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the entropy is fixed.
Yeah. So you know, you do have to assume, you know, and again, you do have to check this at some point, and it has been that, you know, whatever you do in this dark sector doesn't screw up, you know, the what we see in now. And again, you know, so assuming if you had probably if your dark sector has a slightly lower temperature, then even if you have the dark radiation, you can manage it. But this all has been looked at carefully, including, you know, also evolving the Boltzmann codes to see whether we can actually get this. Because this is sort of a static question. You really want to look at the dynamics of it. This has been worked out in great detail by those papers. But all I really wanted to get at is that you can actually get these exponentially large composite states. And so this is sort of what I'm going to call fermionic blobs. They go under different names like dark nuclei, which I'll also use interchangeably, sometimes called nuggets. And these are really just exponentially large states that you generically find in a asymmetric, strongly interacting dark sector. Okay, and simply because this is going to be important later on, I do want to give us a sense of how large these nuclei are in terms of physical units. So for the radii of these fermionic blobs, again, they obey geometric scaling. So the radius goes like essentially an angstrom when the mass is 10 to the 14 GeV, and then it goes like the mass of the 1/3. And then the lighter you make your confinement scale, the larger your radii, essentially you kind of fluff them up. And so for a couple important numbers, if I look at 10 to the 10 GeV dark nuclei or 10 to the 33 GeV dark nuclei with a confinement scale of an MeV and a GeV, then your radii essentially vary for the heaviest constituents and the lightest blobs. It's 10 to minus 13 meters, so less than an angstrom. But if you go up to an MeV and 10 to the 33 GeV, so this is the blob that passes once through the Earth, it gives you about 0.2 meters. So these are fairly large objects. So you might hope they can actually detect them. And just as a sanity check, the Schwarzschild radius, so you know whether these could form a black hole, for 10 to the 10 GeV, orders of magnitude below the radius. And for the 10 to the 33, you're still orders of magnitude below. So these are actually sort of dark nuclei, somewhat like neutron stars, but well away from the Schwarzschild radius. OK, any questions? Yeah?
Do you think that lambda should be of the order of lambda QCD because of the barogenesis through the asymmetric electromagnetism?
So generally, so lambda is generally taken to be small.
It's the balance when you have still the constituents still in masses of freedom. And then the final mass that will be set by the confinement scale should be similar.
So I don't think at all about that. So that is the way one could do it. But if I change lambda, I can just twirl my baryon asymmetry. So, So the reason why I generally take lambda to be small is because of the scaling. So if you want to have large nuclei, large dark nuclei, you have to make lambda small, essentially because then you increase their radius and therefore their fusion cross-section gets bigger. So you know, if you take lambda, you know, above maybe 100 GeV, it becomes very, very hard for these things to fuse quickly enough to get exponentially large. So it's just a constraint on wanting to actually have exponentially large states. And then we don't go less than an MeV because of VBN constraints and things get a little bit wonky. You could, but we generally try and stay above an MeV. Other questions? Okay. So now we sort of have the sector. If these just interacted gravitationally, as we know from previous slides, there's nothing you can do. At least we don't think there is, because their mass is too low to detect gravitationally. So you better hope that there's at least some sort of interaction with the standard model. And so you can look at two different types of couplings or interactions with the standard model, namely via long range and a short range mediator. So with a long range mediator, we assume that the coupling to the dark sector is always scalar-like. And the reason why we do this is if it's scalar-like, you get a coherent enhancement. If it was pseudo-scalar, which it could be, you just couldn't detect it. So we already put a prior on, you know, if these things are detectable, how can they couple? So they really have to couple scalar-like, as far as I can tell. There might be some things you can do, but generally we assume scalar-like. And then coupling to the standard model, we look at three different types of interactions. We look at scalar coupling to the nucleons, the standard model nucleons, pseudoscalar coupling to the nucleons, and a dilaton-like coupling to the electromagnetic field strength tensor. So all three of these interactions can be searched for via ionization, which is essentially your standard direct dark matter direct detection story, or also heat deposition. But these three couplings can also be looked for in unique ways that are unique to their type of coupling. So namely, what I mean is that the scalar coupling can be looked for via acceleration of test masses. The spin coupling, or the pseudoscalar coupling, can be looked for via spin precession. And the dilaton coupling can be used to look, or will induce changes in the fine structure constant. And you can look for that using various experiments. So, of course, there are some constraints on these mediators, including on the standard model side. If I think about standard model constraints, the scalar coupling GN, that is constrained simply by looking at fifth force laws or weak equivalence principle violations, where you can essentially, if you introduce a new scalar coupling, you look at two, let's say, test masses hanging, they'll have additional interactions that aren't just gravity, and so you'll see deviations because of that. The pseudo-scalar coupling, F of N, the constraints there are from white dwarf cooling, supernova neutrino emissions. These are the standard constraints. And then the dilaton coupling, you can actually also use the fifth force constraints and the weak equivalence principle violation, namely because like there's an electromagnetic contribution to the nuclear mass that'll get altered when you have this additional dilaton coupling. So both the scalar coupling and the dilaton coupling can be constrained in similar ways. And then there are also constraints on the mediator coupling to the dark sector. So of course the standard one is the bullet cluster of, you know, how strongly can the dark matter be self-interacting? And this only really applies if dark nuclei aren't subcomponent, but we do constrain them also assuming that they are all of the dark matter. And then of course there's a stability of the dark nuclei, which is what I promised I would get back to. So if I look at the energy, the binding energy, if my nucleus is to be bound, the binding energy has to be positive. And if we have a strong enough Coulombic term, then this term at some point starts to dominate, and my nucleus will no longer be stable. So in order to sort of get these coefficients, we again just go back to, you know, naive dimensional scaling. So for the strong interactions, it has to scale with the confinement scale. And then the weak interactions, this weak interaction is essentially looking at the energy of like a uniform charged sphere. So that just goes like g chi squared. So balancing these two out, you find that if your dark nuclei is large enough, if you want it to be stable, g chi has to satisfy this bound. Now, I'm not gonna mention whether it's natural or not. I'm not gonna say anything about that. I'm just gonna say, if you want stable nuclei, dark nuclei, you have to get below this bound. If you do, is it still possible to detect them? Because this coupling becomes very, very weak. So weak that if you look at just the scalar mediator to nucleons for an MeV constituent and a range of 200 kilometers, you have your self-interaction bounds that are here, sorry, in this sort of light color, where you have the fusion cross-sections essentially here, and then the long-range bound dips down. And then the stability bound is this gray shaded region. So unless you do additional model building, if you want your dark nuclei to be bound and stable, any experiment that you propose or detection method you propose has to dip below this bound. So the question is, can you actually get that, especially as the constraint on the scalar coupling to the standard model tells you that GN has to be weaker than gravity.
Self-interactions is?
So the self-interactions, where it is, it's above. So it's this line. And that's just looking at like the momentum transfer cross-section for a long-range mediator. Between the dark nuclei.
Why is there a bound like going through?
Yeah, so this is, so if I turn off the long-range mediator, I still have the fusion cross-section. And so it's this. So this is sort of done in an approximate way.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
Yeah, I understand that. There must be constraints also on the phenomenology of the scalar field. So first of all, I mean, in principle, you don't expect, because this pi is so light, you expect some sine contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's also the issue, because the coupling that you're considering is so large and the mass of the guy is so low, forget about, there's also issues of two in the mass, which I'm completely ignoring,
mm-hmm.
but there's a functional tuning of the potential, because when you calculate the quality,
yeah.
at higher powers, then they become important. So the question is there a regime where the potential of the phi, because I assume you're treating it as a carbon interaction.
Yeah.
So if other corrections are important, then that's no longer true, right?
Yeah, so our...
Check that.
So, and you're thinking sort of inside the dark nucleus itself?
No, even outside, because it sources, or in the early universe, because this phi is sourced by these dark blobs. So how much phi do you source? And also, I'm thinking about radiative corrections. Forget about the mass,
yeah.
Because let's accept the tune of the mass.
Yeah.
There is a bound on self on the quartic.
Yeah.
Of phi, which I assume you're ignoring.
Yeah.
And for such like masses, I mean, this is a huge quantity. Even
yeah.
It would go like G guy 4. It's
yeah.
Still a big quantity for
the yeah.
guy. And then they're higher order correction.
Yeah.
So the question is, how much control do you have over the potential of phi?
Yeah, so that is something that we did not look at. And so that is something that should be looked at and should be considered. The interesting thing about this is, you know, so I sort of focus on a scalar mediator.
Yes.
I can also, instead of having a scalar, I can take like a vector mediator. Because essentially everything about the stability bound will be the same for a repulsive interaction. And that might make things a little bit better. But you know, these are sort of model-specific questions one should ask and does need to be asked, and we have not thought about them. We haven't looked at them in great detail. Okay, so again, so essentially for any detection method, you really want to be somewhere below here, which is seems like it should be hard to do. So the first thing one can look at is say, okay, let's take the standard dark matter direct detection story, where you look at ionization or scintillation signals. And essentially the general idea there is that you look at the momentum transfer between your dark matter and a single standard model atom and see if you can transfer enough energy such that an electron gets ionized. So if I have my big dark matter blob, I have my standard model atom, they interact via long range potential, and the standard model atom is essentially pushed slightly away, it has some momentum transfer. Because the dark matter is so large and you have this long range mediator, you only find small angle scattering. So this is similar to the old story of the plum pudding model, where you had the entire atom was made of positive charge, and then you had the famous gold foil experiment that said you had a nucleus. So this is essentially a plum pudding model. And there you only find small angle scattering. And you will only get ionization if the momentum transfer is above 100 keV, which is very hard to do because of this small angle scattering. So much so that if we go back to this plot and we look at the largest experiment that you have for ionization, which is essentially MACRO, which was a magnetic monopole detector that ran for 10 years in Gran Sasso, it's this little red triangle, which is very, very small and very, very far away from the stability bound. And this is essentially, again, the statement that because you have this very, very large charge distribution that's diffuse, it's not concentrated, it is very hard to transfer momentum. Okay, so that doesn't work. Next, we can look at heat deposition, where instead of looking at the energy transfer to a single atom, you look at the bulk energy deposition into a material. And so the general idea here is that you can utilize the fact that blobs have a very large radius, and so they interact with a large number of standard model atoms within that radius. So again, if I take my dark matter and I take my standard model atom, I can pack in a large number of standard model atoms within that blob, and therefore the total energy that's deposited per angstrom in your material scales like the ratio of the radii squared. Now, this depends on you being in what's called the guaranteed hit regime, where essentially if the standard model is anywhere near the blob, it will see a potential and thus be scattered. So it's a sort of away from like the standard WIMP story where the cross sections are way too small. But in that case, you now have a large blob that can transfer a lot of bulk energy, but very, very little into a single single atom. So as an example of where this could work, hydrophones in a tank of water are sensitive to an energy deposition of 10 keV per angstrom. So assuming your blob is large enough, it can avoid the ionization bound from macro, but still be found in like a hydrophone experiment. So going back to our plot, again, there's macro in its little triangle, and then the hydrophones get you closer. And so the cut here is essentially using the cut of the exposure, where we assume a 500 meter tank that's cubed. And so you can't ever get a dark matter that passes through the tank of greater than 10 to the 25 if you're only integrating for 1 year. You can also use magnetic crystals, which are much smaller than hydrophones, but they have a much lower energy threshold. And so they help you a little bit, but you're still not getting anywhere near the stability bound. So that's kind of looking bad. You can also look at the sort of how this scales based on the fact that at 10 to the 18 GeV for your dark matter, this radius goes like 10 to the 4 angstroms. And at 10 to the 25, it's 5 times 10 to the 6 angstrom. So you can look at that scaling to figure out how well hydrophones do. OK, so that looks bad. We're getting nowhere near the stability bound. So we can do one more thing, which is to look at accelerations. So essentially, as a blob passes near a test mass, they interact, and they will push each other away or towards each other, depending on the charge. So my dark matter moves, my test mass moves. And this, of course, is a very, very small strain. The total change is very, very small. But we have great experiments that are great at looking for very, very small deviations from zero. So LIGO, for example, is sensitive to about 0.1 centimeters per root hertz in its frequency band. So when we look for that, we finally get below the stability bound. So this purple triangle here is LIGO. This is AEGIS, which is an atomic interferometer, atomic clock interferometer, sometimes also called MAGIS. They added the M. And so finally, we managed to get orders of magnitude below that stability bound. So despite the weakness of the coupling between the scalar and the standard model, and the weakness in the coupling between the mediator and the dark sector, because you have this large dark nucleus that has a large number of constituents, you are able to compensate for that and see a signal.
Sorry, but this is, so the LIGO, so because there are two things on top of each other,
yeah,
so, you see LIGO is the smaller one.
Yeah, so this is LIGO, and then AEGIS is down here. And so that mainly just has to do with like matching the transit times to the frequency band. And so
you're assuming you can see a single kick.
So
that's a bit tricky for gravity detectors, right? Because there are many things that can use to do a single kick.
Yeah. So
how would you correlate?
Yeah, so you are right. It is hard. You know, there's a couple things that you can use. You can use the fact, you know, that this transient signal, you know, has a particular velocity to it. And, you know, based on the orientation that it's coming into your detector, that, you know, that kick will have a certain profile to it.
Yeah,
so
how would that be different? I don't know how that is different from someone walking next to your mirror or walking next to
So the other thing is, so this also takes into account the fact, you know, that this ends up affecting both mirrors. It doesn't affect both Hanford and Livermore, but it will affect both mirrors. So you can look for that.
That may mean also that the sensitivity.
So that is taken into account in the sensitivity curve.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
yeah, so the velocity helps a lot.
Yeah, but the question is, can you have? Yeah, that's true, because the signal would be the size is so transient signal. How long does it last? How long is it?
So essentially, it depends on exactly where the dark matter comes in and how far away. So here, so these are pretty much matched to the reason, you know. So LIGO here is matched to, I think like 100 hertz, and then AEGIS I think is matched to 1 hertz. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so to actually be able to draw, you know, true constraints, one does have to figure out, you know, the wave functions, you know, the distribution of how far the dark matter will be and thing, all of that. So this is more, again, illustrative than actually, you know, these aren't actual constraints. These are just sensitivity of.
And that's the issue that I told you about. If you're talking about scalar things,
yeah,
then the relation I told you, which is not clear. I don't know where it would lie.
So my suspicion is that there is sort of there is a slight way around that, because I actually have spent a little bit of time thinking about it, but let's talk after the seminar about this, because you are right. There are things to consider, and I...
Let's continue.
Yeah. Okay.
For a lot of the searches, though, right? Because right now, they do filter out glitches, right?
Yeah, so...
These things be filtered out?
I think that they could be filtered out right now, but I firmly believe... almost firmly believe that you could construct a wave function that like a trigger for LIGO that they wouldn't be
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you can utilize the velocity and the profile of the signal and things like that. So I think it would look very different than like a particle hitting, you know, or someone walking by or a train
or a power fluctuation. Because power fluctuations is much faster than things moving. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So I believe that they can do it. One just has to do it carefully. Okay. Good. So the takeaway from this is, you know, in order to actually dip below the stability bound, you have to use very, very sensitive detectors. I mean, LIGO is beautifully sensitive, and that's really what's going to save us. So moving on to pseudoscalar coupling, where we're going to use spin precession. The general idea is that as the blob passes near a detector, it causes your standard model spins to rotate by a very, very small amount. So normally you would say, no, the small amount is way too small for any detector to pick up. However, if you have a material where all of the spins are pointing in the same direction, a change in the spin orientation changes the magnetization of the entire material. And luckily, we have very, very sensitive detectors, namely SQUIDs, that can actually detect very, very small changes in magnetization. So CASPER, which is an axion detector, the SQUIDs in CASPER are sensitive to a change of 0.1 femtotesla per root hertz. They're pretty much at the quantum limit. Looking at the sensitivity of CASPER to these passing blobs, again, hydrophones will get you a little bit, but it really is these NMR, this CASPER experiments, that get you below that stability bound. And it is because SQUIDs come to your rescue. They are extremely sensitive, and CASPER is able to align all of their spins in one direction for a
scale thing. For example, here you're assuming lambda.
Of an MeV.
The Earth,
yes, yeah.
Lambda, not big.
Sorry,
lambda.
Little lambda.
Little lambda.
Yeah.
Little lambda is of the Earth radius. So, yeah. How does the shape change if you, and what assumptions have you made for this NMR thing? Is it like the ultimate crazy CASPER thing?
I don't think it's the ultimate crazy. I think it was the original published thing, just based on you know, how sensitive, the fact that SQUIDs work at the quantum level. So I don't think it's the ultimate crazy. And I know when we were making this, Sergi had just told me that they had managed to get all of their spins to be perfectly aligned with zero field for 10 seconds at a time. Okay. So this actually was based on what experimentalists told us they could do in CASPER, had actually seen.
Mm-hmm.
So the shapes here, so there's a reason why sort of this shape changes from this. So you have to sort of assume, you know, how close can your blob get? So for this unshaded region, based on the number density, you can always you'll have at least one blob that passes within, I believe this is 1 meter of the CASPER experiment per year. And then as you go past that, you know, 10 to the 22, it might actually be 10 meters. At that point, the number density is too high, so you're not going to find a blob passing within a meter. You're going to have it finding, you know, 10 meters, 20 meters, 30. And so you top out here, where essentially you won't find a blob passing within the range of the mediator of the Casper experiment.
So basically, the whole thing I should imagine as this line moving, the vertical line.
This one?
This one moving. If I were to make 6,000
yeah.
kilometers, make 60 meters.
Yeah, then it'll shift in this way. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so this is one of the things why this long-range mediator is so useful, because even though Casper itself is about, their material is about 10 centimeters total cube, because you have this long-range mediator, essentially grow the effective size of your detector. So of course, if you go to shorter mediators, it gets harder because you don't get this effective size. Okay. Ooh. So the last long-range mediator that one could look at, or we looked at, was a dilaton coupling to electromagnetic field strength tensor, where this essentially alters the fine structure constant and therefore alters bond lengths and also masses. So if I think about altering bond lengths, as my dark matter blob passes by, my test mass expands and then contracts. Essentially, my fine structure constant changes based on sort of like the VEV of this field that's sourced by this dark matter, and that induces a strain. So if you think about like LIGO, as this blob passes through, all of LIGO, the ground shifts and everything expands and the mirrors get moved apart. And so again, once again using LIGO, LIGO sensitive to now strains of about 10 to the minus 20, well, 22, 23 per root hertz. And so, once again, looking at an MEV constituent now with a range of 200 kilometers, macro does a bit better, hydrophones do better. Actually, for the first time, my hydrophones and magnetic crystals dip ever so slightly below that stability bound. But again, Aegis and LIGO just save you because they're just simply so precise. Okay. My last couple of minutes. So we've seen how having a long-range mediator sort of allows blobs to be detected despite them having these heavy masses, because you can utilize the entire range of the mediator to cause an effect in your detectors. Now, one would expect that as you go to the short-range mediator, where you no longer have that increase in the effective size, things will get a little bit harder. So we only really looked at one short-range mediator, which is really essentially the one that gives you a dimension 6-4 Fermi interaction. That's sort of the standard contact interaction. And we only considered interactions between the blobs and the constituents, sorry, the blob constituents and the standard model nuclei. You can generally set the couplings G chi and Gn to be order 1, and then place a bound on mu, which is the mass of the mediator. So to sort of be safe from like LHC constraints, things like that, we take mu to be greater than a TeV. And then these can only really be looked for ionization and heat deposition signatures, because all of these ultra-precise detectors are either very, very small, or you don't have a large enough signal because you don't have that nice integrated time. You don't have that good coherence. And so in fact, for these sorts of interactions, because of the large size of the blob, the incoherent scattering is what dominates, not the coherent. So you don't actually get an n squared enhancement in the coherent one. And that's just due to like unitarity constraints and things like that, which I'm happy to discuss in greater detail, but offline, because it gets a little bit tricky. So looking only at ionization and scintillation signals, if I look at a short-range mediator of a mass of a TeV, and I've set Gn and G chi to be order 1, so I'm just looking at the dark matter mass and the mediator mass in GeV. So there's the self-interaction constraints from essentially the fusion cross-section in the bullet cluster. Then macro makes a really nice constraint because you have this very, very big detector that ran for a long time, and you can now get ionization signatures. So you get this nice little cut from macro. Hydrophones, again, your blob is still large, so you can still get the sort of enhancement due to the radius. So hydrophones, if you have a big enough tank, let you peek up above macro. And then lastly, you can also use CDMS. So this CDMS is not the typical ionization or scintillation CDMS. This is actually CDMS that we'll soon be able to run looking at heat deposition, not ionization signatures. And they do it with quite a nice low threshold. And so they dip below, they cover space that's not covered by macro because of that lower threshold. Okay, so to summarize, so again, this work was motivated by the observation that the dark matter mass, without any sort of model priors, spans over 90 orders of magnitude. Sort of stemming from, you know, having to have the dark matter mass be able to, its Compton wavelength fit in a galaxy, to essentially the heaviest primordial black holes. And in that 90 orders of magnitude, there's this mass range between 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 33 GeV that has been underexplored and is hard to explore. And so we focused on using Earth-based experiments for this. So I have hopefully two takeaways that you will take with you. The first, that there actually are viable dark matter candidates in this mass regime, that it isn't just done to explore because there hasn't been that much exploration, but that there is actually a viable dark matter candidate. And an example of this is a strongly coupled dark sector with an asymmetry. And other models or ideas do exist, but this is the one I focused on. And then the second takeaway is that despite the heaviness of these dark blobs, despite the fact that their number density is so low, you can still use Earth-based detectors. You just have to compensate for the very weak coupling with large N and use coherence. And that based on your mediator type, you have to use different experiments. But the key thing is, again, we're not proposing new experiments. You're using existing or near future experiments, just perhaps run with different triggers looking for different signatures. But essentially, you can look for dark blobs using existing experimental methods. So things I did not discuss is you can also think about, you know, what if the blobs aren't created out of fermion constituents, but instead are bosonic, and have a different scaling law, where essentially the more constituents I put into my blob, my radius doesn't change. And so that gives you slightly different detection stories. Some of the work we're currently working on, or I'm working on, is if you move away from this guaranteed hit regime, where your blobs start being more WIMP-like, how would you detect them? Are they still detectable? And then future work, what I'm really interested in is how to go from Earth-based experiments to astrophysical, where if you're heavier than, let's say, 10 to the 33 GeV, you can no longer use things based on Earth because the volume's not big enough. So of course, you compensate for your increased exposure by a massive decrease in sensitivity, because you're not going to have a giant squid on a neutron star, unfortunately. And so the question is whether there's still something that can be done in that sort of upper mass regime. And with that, thank you.
You must be making an assumption about the coupling of the mediator to nucleons.
Yes.
Which you didn't show in the plots.
No, I did. I did. Oh, sorry. Sorry. I'm still learning how to describe plots.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Here, what is the?
Oh, sorry.
Assuming here for the coupling to matter.
Yeah. So in all of these plots, I have assumed that I've saturated the existing bound.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this is all. So this takes into account the. Fifth force and weak.
Okay, so what if you, how does it scale this? Is it the product that you constrain? So then.
So essentially,
if I were to make G nucleon a factor of 10 smaller, this goes back up a factor of 10.
And yeah, so they always come in together, multiplied. Yeah. No, it's my first paper with actual plots in it, so I'm still learning how to describe them. Thank you. Other questions?
Well, so you mentioned, you know, so like neutron stars as a possible astrophysical laboratory, you know, sort of things.
Yeah, so the thing that I've been interested in, which is sort of partially how I thought a little bit about the scalar potential question, is so not using the neutron star itself, but using like pulsar timing arrays, right? Because we think that if I have a primordial black hole, I believe of a mass of like 10 to the 25 grams that goes by the Earth, you know, the Earth gets a gravitational kick, and thus all of your pulsar timing arrays move, all of your pulsars, their timing switches a little bit. And so you can essentially look for that gravitational kick of the Earth. Now, imagine you have a long-range mediator, a scalar mediator. And while it is true that the coupling between the standard model and the mediator is weaker than gravity, the constraint on the coupling to the dark sector can be stronger than gravity. So you can essentially compensate for the weakness of gravity, sorry, for the weakness of the coupling on the standard model side by increasing the coupling on, in the dark sector. I haven't quite gotten it to work without tuning because of this darn stability bound. Because that essentially tells you, you know, that instead of having your coupling grow with n, it really goes with n to the 2/3. And so unfortunately, it looks like it almost exactly compensates. Like you could maybe get like a couple orders of magnitude below that, you know, gravitational only interaction. So I would love to find some way to sort of weaken the stability bound, but I haven't found a good way to do it that isn't incredibly contrived. But you know, stuff like that. Other questions?
I have one.
Yeah.
I mean, you skipped over it. So I wanted to explain the coherence thing, and go back to the article, the last book that you have. So
this one.
Case.
Yeah.
So for example, there's a kink there.
Yeah.
So the cross section is just the reduced mass. Mm-hmm. The reduced mass. So reduced mass, what is it like?
Yeah, so yeah, so this is essentially because so here, so it shifts a little bit because I'm you know, I'm not looking off of scattering off of nucleons. I'm looking off of the nuclei of these various detectors. So that's why it's sort of not all exactly lined up. But yeah, but that kink is exactly the reduced mass changeover.
Of the system. So basically, the cross section here is just 1/4 times the reduced mass.
Yeah. And so then the coherence issue is essentially, you know, if you think about when we talk about coherence and incoherence, when you think about quantum mechanical scattering, you're always assuming that you're in the plane wave limit. And because these objects are so big, for essentially these masses, you can no longer treat the scattering as just plain wave scattering. You have to take into account wave functions.
Yeah, so you're taking, what is the effective nuclear mass here? Because it's not really, the curve happens around 10 to 20.
Yes, yeah, so slightly less than 0.1.
So it's set by the QCT scale, not the size of the object? So what enters there, so in the cross section? Because now I'm confused, because this thing, as it enters the detector, it overlaps many nuclei, right?
Yeah, so you kind of have to, you know, say, okay, now if I have, you know, a single, you know, nucleus, interacting, you know, with this object, sort of how does it scatter, and then sort of build up, you know, okay, how many of them are included in this cross section or not, and so it's sort of, you kind of just have to, you know, build it up that way, you know, so it's the density comes into play, you know, the effective size, the mass, I don't have it, unfortunately, on a backup slide, but I have it in this, so we can go through it. Other questions?
Can you find the rod again?